confronting the world, we're going to just look at the quick aspects of them, because the fact that the world is really one. I remember way back, and many of you don't, of course, but Wendell Willkie ran, and he was opposed to the concept of one world. And people said, it isn't one world, huh? And one worldisms, or those who supported the idea of one world, were thought to be unpatriotic, almost non-American, that, you know, we should all be one world. But that anyone, I think, has to recognize today that indeed this is one world. And so there are issues that Lester Brown, in his book and his books, maybe not so much in this one, which is the State of the World of 89, but Lester Brown says, we are crossing thresholds, unknowingly in so many cases, thresholds that we will not be able to recross for decades to come. And a quick one that I think all of you will appreciate is the ozone problem. Getting larger and larger. In fact, last year Lester Brown says it increased by some 3%. Well, what is that? You know, what are the ramifications of that? It's the ramifications, some of them medical, an increase in skin cancers, a decrease in crops, because this protective shield around the earth will no longer keep out ultraviolet rays, which are harmful in so many areas. But we did it unknowingly. And what will it take to cross that threshold again? Roger Shin, an ethicist at the Union Theological Seminary in New York, wrote a book called Forced Options. We think we have so many options available to us, but we don't. They're forced upon us by our own activities. Henry Ford, you know, he didn't start the automobile, but he started the idea of separation of labor, that one guy only handles wheels and another guy, what is that called? Assembly line concept, but there's another aspect. But anyhow, Henry Ford had no idea that his vehicle, you know, would be responsible for the smog in Los Angeles. And he didn't even conceive of it. And we now have forced upon us certain things that we have to do. He didn't know, he may have known, but he wasn't concerned by the fact that, you know, petroleum was a limited product. And now we have to start looking at things and wonder whether we can really do anything about it. And we have crossed that threshold where we're now so dependent upon the automobile and the internal combustion machine that, you know, some people say we have enough oil to last for 2020. And then what happens? So things change. In a collage of headlines during 1988 and 87 and surely in 89 would cry out that the world is at risk. Things that we have accepted as everyday realities and goods are now becoming things less than beneficial to mankind. The global reality of climate increasing in warmth. The 4 years that have been the warmest in the last century have occurred in the 1980s. 1980, 81, 83, 87. And maybe 88, where the final results aren't in, might soon also join that group. What are the, how's that going to impinge upon our life and the life we know here on this planet? During 1988, there were 10 consecutive days in central China where the temperature exceeded 100 degrees Fahrenheit. And the hospitals were full of patients suffering from heat stroke and exhaustion. Hundreds of people died. Crop yields during last year, 1988, in the United States dropped for the first time to less than domestic consumption. It was 89, and some of you heard Dick Buescher talking about rainfalls. They came in 20-year cycles, said he. And we might be at the low trough of one of those cycles. Is 89 going to produce less food than we're going to consume domestically? Not only does the ozone, for example, affect skin cancer, but if you're along, and certainly some of you must be, along this coast, Pacific coast, fish that were caught off the coast of California are now being caught off of the Oregon-Washington coast. And fish that were caught here are now going up further into Canada. Warming cycle. And you all know the impact of a warming cycle, if it's only 1 or 2 degrees, what impact that might have on the snow of the Arctic and Antarctic and the rising water, that parts of New York would be flooded. And Dhaka, East Pakistan, or not East Pakistan, it's now called Bangladesh, 90 miles from the coast, and yet it has an elevation of 3 feet. And if the water of the ocean rises, what's going to happen? And so the world is at risk, I suggest to you, and that Bangladesh is a good example of what's happening in the area of deforestation. I mentioned somewhere, and maybe in this group, that desertification, for example, that every second the desert expands the size of 2 football fields every second, according to the ICRC in Geneva, the International Commission of Red Cross. How long can that continue? In fact, if the desert of the world were compressed into a small area, it would mean 13% of Iowa would be under desert in 1 year. And as the desert advances, and as trees are cut down, more desert occurs. People go to other areas. They start climbing those hills, like in Guatemala, as I spoke about at dinner last night, going up the hills, terracing, contour terracing, but that means they have to cut down more trees. And you know, a thing that we North Americans forget is that we are in some measure, large or small, responsible for a lot of the damage that's happening in other places. We don't like to think so, but we are. I'd like to take you to Central America, where the forest is being cut down in order to provide range for beef cattle. And after 2 or 3 years, maybe 3 or 4, that range no longer produces the grasses that will sustain cattle life, and so you cut down more forests. In fact, the magazine Foreign Affairs, back about late 86 or the spring issue of 87, called it the hamburger connection. The fact that that beef down there is then exported to the United States, and you can still get a Big Mac for $1.75. We're concerned about the cutting of the forest in the Amazon. And I was annoyed I guess it was December 18 of last year issue, where an editorial was written the uprising, or the rising up of people in Brazil, not with AK-47s, but with chainsaws, and how bad that was, huh? And we had to do something to stop it. You see, but the reason those chainsaws are operating in Brazil is because of a demand on the part of Northerners, Western Europeans, Japanese, Australians, Canadians, Americans, for mahogany furniture, for teak furniture. If there was no market, nobody would cut those trees down. And if you were reading Our Common Future by Brundtland, which is also available in the bookstore, and I think whether you're interested in what's happening in this class or not, that book should be, I don't want to be sacrilegious early and say it should be right next to your Bible, because it's so important for all of us in the world to understand what's happening in the world ecologically. Which is what is the burden of Lester Brown, saying that we've got to do something about it. And you see, the poor people who live in poverty can't worry about the fact that they're cutting down a tree because they've got to feed their family. They've got to make the budget stretch. And not only is this affecting the, for example, the tropical forest in the Amazon, but it's interesting to note that in that forest, if you have the lists here of the seafood, and you have the Amazon coming up here, that previously the rainfall, 25% of it used to run off. And 75% of it was re-evaporated up into the clouds to fall further upriver. And that happened continually, that cycle, until it hits the Andy Mountains here. And I hope I'm not looking up somebody's only butcher paper here. But that water used to hit that mountains and then turn south into one of the greatest farming areas in Brazil. But now with deforestation, the runoff is as much as 50%. And that means there's only 50% for this cycle to continue. And what's happening down here? Well, it was like the drought in mid-America the past year. And what used to be a very productive area is now becoming, I won't say a desert, but is less productive than it was before. Ramifications. And our role is not inconsequential. As you know, I live in New Jersey, and last summer I heard that something like $800 or $900 million were lost to New Jersey for the lack of tourism. Why? Because medical waste, sewage waste, needles still containing blood, were washing ashore upon the Jersey Shore. And the Jersey Shore, you know, in the east anyhow, is one of the great gold mines as far as tourism is concerned. But nobody went, because they were all there on the sand. Seals in Northern Europe died by the thousands because of toxic wastes. In the Adriatic, that ocean or that sea between Yugoslavia and Italy, swimming was prohibited by the Italian government because of pollution. Soviet Union stopped swimming in the Black Sea, the Baltic Sea, and the Aral Sea, again, because of pollution of the water. Not only does it kill fish, you see, but it can kill people's livelihood. And so you see that there are some things that are occurring that have to be done, that have to be stopped. In West Africa, the fact that the West African countries are now finally protesting, and rightly they should, the dumping of toxic wastes on their land. Not only by North Americans, and particularly by Americans, United States people, but also by the Italians and by the French. And I suggest to you this afternoon that the natural world seems to be striking back, saying, hey, you can only pollute us so long. In Germany, they call it Waldsterben, the death of the forest, acid rain. And there's an organization now of European states that have agreed that by 1991, they will reduce sulfuric carbon acids or expulsion from factories by 30%. Indeed, Germany and Denmark and one other country, I forget, are advocating a reduction of 70%. And it reflects, this strike back by nature is reflected in the growth of green parties in both the East and in the West. Green Party, as you know, is sitting in the Bundestag today in the Germany, in the German parliament. And why? Because people are saying, hey, we're not only killing the forest, we're killing ourselves. You see, we have to start realizing that our environment and our world is not given to us as a gift from our mothers and fathers. It's really a loan from our children and grandchildren. And what are they going to have if we continue to pollute the world? And so the world, I suggest to you, is at risk. And the world is striking back. And these thresholds that we cross are not always perceptible. We don't know it. And that's what, again, Lester Brown suggests, that we unknowingly cross these issues. And it's interesting that things that we once thought were absolutely okay to do, cut down a tree without any concern, kind of reminds me, for example, of slavery, which was once a right. It's a right to have slaves, and now it's an abomination. Or the subjugation of women in was common practice, and still is, unfortunately, in many parts of the world. But it's a reprehensible condition today. And so, you know, our mindset is changing, and it should, and it better, and quickly. And it's a world at risk, and not just the United States or Canada or Russia or Guatemala or any place you pick. And a proof of that is Chernobyl. And the Laplanders in Lapland who depend upon the reindeer found that they, you know, couldn't export and sell their reindeer, couldn't eat the meat because of radiation. And I was in Switzerland shortly after Chernobyl, and the Swiss didn't drink their own milk. And Western Europe didn't eat their own vegetables. And the Poles wanted to get iodine tablets for their children in order to counter this cloud that didn't stop at the German-Polish border or any other border, but went on over. It's a global problem. And scientists in Hawaii can tell within a day when farmers in China began their spring plowing. because it takes about 2 weeks for that dust being blown from their fields to reach Hawaii. Now, how long can you continue that kind of abuse of soil? In Iowa, the black soil used to go down 20 feet, I'm told. It's less than 4 today. And so what was once our breadbasket may indeed one day become, you know, our inland desert. And as climate changes, people are predicting that, you know, the Dakotas will get more rain, will produce more. Southern Canada will become the great producer, and it's already a great producer. And Kansas and Nebraska and Iowa and Illinois will be producing less. That has a lot of ramifications. And so really what we have to do is start thinking about interdependence. What happens somewhere else we should be concerned about, certainly in the ecology and in the environment. I want to show you a map again, if I can get it working. This happens to be a map where LWR works, and but I'm using it because it's the only map I have of the world, and you can see that this is a Peters projection. But the point is that what's happening in Brazil and what's happening in Russia, what's happening in Guatemala and Honduras, where they're cutting the forests, what's happening in the Sahel, where the desert is increasing, as I say, the size of 2 football fields every second, has to be concerned to us here in North America. Indeed, it has to be a concern to every place. Go over here to Bangladesh, where we work. It's a country the size of Wisconsin or the size of Florida, whichever one you want. It has 104 million people. And last October, one of the great floods of the century occurred there. And there are those who say, well, it just was an unhappy consequence of a confluence of high water from the Indian Ocean as well as a monsoon. And that doesn't often occur, said they. But what really was happening, I suggest to you, is that Nepal and India, here in Nepal, here in India, have been cutting their forests to such a degree that the runoff is tremendous. 25 million people were homeless in Bangladesh, September and October. 2/3 of the country was underwater. We, LWR, happened to give $300,000 to try and help those who are homeless. What we should have done, and we will in the future, if I have anything to say about it, is we'll give them maybe $200,000 and say, we will give you another $100,000 if India and Bangladesh and Nepal and anybody else and the United Nations will get together and have an international conference to try and resolve the root causes of flooding. You can set your calendar to September and know there's going to be a flood in Bangladesh. And it's as sure as tomorrow's sunset. But we ought to start looking at the root causes. It kind of reminds me of the guy who was standing on a bridge and he saw this body coming down the river. He took off his shirt and jumped in and saved the guy. And he just got this guy back on his feet and he looked down there and there was another guy. And he jumped in and grabbed this guy and pulled him out. And after about the fourth or fifth guy, he said, hey, wait a while. Where are these people coming from? He went upstream and there was somebody pushing him off the bridge up there. So he could have worked his pants off rescuing these people, But what he should have done was upstream and stop the individual from pushing these people off the bridge. Get back to the root cause. All you're doing here is putting a band-aid and treating the results of some underlying root cause. Let me just throw a few other slides up here, our overheads on the, for your information. Look what's happening to food production. Between 1961 and 83, look what's happening to sub-Saharan Africa. It's going down. And at the same time, its population is going up. But not only is it caused by population, it's also caused by desertification. And when the two come together, you start getting pictures like this. And we'll be talking later this week, is today Friday? Tomorrow, on the African continent and some of the problems that it has. Let me see if I can show you another one. And how important it is, for example, to have clean water, which, you know, only half the people in the world, in fact, something like 49% of the people in the world have access to clean water. And sometimes, you know, we who are so content with ourselves, we here in the United States, we have a lot of places at home that don't have clean water here either. And we are draining, for example, that aquifer down in southwest United States dry. But look how important clean water is to infant mortality. When you have access, almost only 10 or 15% infant mortality is that high. And there's almost a direct relationship between access to clean water and reducing infant mortality. Furthermore, and this happens to be another slide I'll use again, note the direct relationship between literacy for women and infant mortality. The higher the rate of literacy, the lower the rate of literacy, the higher the rate of infant mortality.
Can you see what the different columns are? I don't have my glasses on. I can't.
This one is infant mortality rate of percent. This is access to clean water. And this is female literacy percent. So that, for example, down here, where you have the United States and France, and almost 100% literacy rate among women, you have some of the lowest infant mortality rates. Not only do you have an low infant mortality rate, I might say that this corresponds almost equally to birth rates. That the higher the literacy rate of women, the lower the birth rate. Now this happens to be infant mortality, but it also applies to birth rate itself. And so the world is at risk. And these are just some examples of how it affects and impacts upon us. I'm going to stop there for a moment and see if you have some thoughts yourself, how you have seen some aspects maybe of a world at risk, or if you have some comments and would like to maybe take exception to something that I've said.
Yes, sir. I made the point that a number of people have with the, I suppose, the ecological damage being done and the exploitation of food and my thoughts then turn to what practical matters to be done about this. If we were to put a tariffs on imported agricultural products, would this be desirable or step in the right direction? Would this cause more harm than good?
No. Well, that's an interesting question, and I'm not sure it's black and white, but let me take that in relation to, for example, Honduras Guatemala, where a lot of deforestation is occurring, so that they can raise cattle. If we put a tax on the importation of beef, we'll say, it'll cause the price of beef to go up. It'll cause us maybe to eat less meat. And that...
I presume the president...
Sure, that's right. It would do the second thing, and more important in my view. You see, in the development game, we call that cash crops. They grow this beef for export, but they don't grow anything for their own subsistence. We think that, and we're not trying to make these people, you know, to eat less protein, and we just want them to eat more food. And we say, instead of pasture land for beef, this should be land upon which people can grow whatever they eat, yams, and vegetables, and fruit, fruit trees among the vegetables, that they would then have enough to eat. You gotta buy food from the United States. Why don't they grow? Because they get for the peanuts, doesn't pay for all the food they need to grow. I mean, they need to import themselves. Why don't they grow their own food? Uganda wants to grow cotton and tobacco for export. Well, why don't they grow yams and other foods for their own family, subsistence? So if you put a tax, it seems to me, it will be less profitable to grow beef down there, and people will start thinking about growing food for their own subsistence. And it will be more expensive for us, and maybe we would eat less beef, and then you could say then it would help American beef producers. And so that's a trade-off you have to look at. And I'm not sure always, you see, that we are ready to pay more for beef or eat less beef. But I think we have to start changing some of our lifestyles.
Isn't it true, like, that the top 10% of Mexico, owned by a few corporate farmers, do the same thing, ship vegetables and fruits in off seasons to America? And those people profit immensely, but the poor have no food. And someone said about 70 families control all Mexico.
I don't know about Mexico, I do know about El Salvador, where 13 families control 90% of the land. I know that for a fact. But you see, that's another problem, is the distribution of land. And I'm really very, and I think it's recognized, with Mrs. Aquino in the Philippines and People Power. She's one of the largest landowners in the Philippines. She has yet to divide her land among the people, even though the land's been, theoretically, the law has been passed that you have to divide the land. Some of you played Star Power in this room yesterday. Huh? And that's when you have power, you're out to people. And I'd like to know, revolution, modern times, where the revolutionaries soon themselves don't become despotic. And start impressing, suppressing people. Other thoughts? Yes, sir.
Many years ago, in fact, from VA, under the clear Clean Air Act, issued an order to bomb the state of Wisconsin. And I don't know if it was supposed to Iowa or Illinois, but they had to have a certain set of clean air. And that meant farmers had to spend a great deal of money to get the white goods or the air washers in place. But before they even had them designed, they got another order out telling them instead of having 85% clean air, they had to have, I think it was 92% clean air. Well, that meant going back to the designer, the corporation, and spending another lump of money, which is a bigger lump than the first because of the And then when they got that design, one factory and corporation I know of wanted to know how long they could depend on that being in place if they went ahead and did it. And they're talking about $3.5 million for a little funding. And the first thing you know, they waited for 3 months, couldn't get any answer. And then they finally, through pressure, got an answer that the EPA didn't even know if they would be operating 30 days or 30 years. I had no idea. The end result is the foundries moved to Mexico, across the border. So did the business buying of the castings into Mexico. But they didn't do anything about having the airport back in the United States.
What can be done about it?
I think a little more. I don't really know, except that if you put a tariff on castings coming back in, all it's going to do is raise the price of the product in this country, nothing more. And I'm not so sure that the... I really fault the EPA and its regulations without having decent goals set ahead of time so people know what the goals are.
For example, the number of miles of cars that roll on a gallon of gasoline. We've set that scale up. You remember at one time, I don't know if these figures are right, but there were 27, 28 miles a car had to go. And interestingly enough, it's not a car. It's the producer's series of cars. I mean, you take Chevrolet or General Motors, that meant any car from their GM production, Chevrolet, Cadillac, Oldsmobile, Buick, whatever they all are, that collectively, they had to, say, go 27 miles to the gallon. And of course, they got a few little small cars that will do 40, and that takes care of the car that does 18 on the other end. But we'll say it was 27. Now it's been reduced, and now it's going back up. But I think, you see, this is where we come in, all of us. I was saying that at one time, slavery was a right. Now, of course, we're opposed to it. I think the same thing has got to go through our mind. I think the narrow interest of our personal lives or of economic or political gain must fall away. We've got to write to our congresspeople and say, hey, we want 80% or 90% of the dust and dirt scrubbed out of the chimneys that spew out this poison, huh? But we don't. Or maybe we do it, but maybe our Congress doesn't listen to us, and then we better turn the rascals out. You see, we've got to start preserving and being convinced that preserving human life on this planet is more important than national or private wealth. And that's quite a change to our way of thinking, I think. And I'm not sure that everybody is ready to do that. And we need to raise the understanding and the concern and the voices of people if we're really concerned about it. If we're not, then don't bother. I'm not saying you have to, and I'm not saying I'm right. I just think that when you go into Eastern Canada and see the results of acid rain that are coming from factories in Chicago, primarily Gary Anna, and maybe in Ohio, and see what's happening to the forests. We ought to be concerned about that. How long can that go on? You are.
You sure are.
Sure you are, and you should be. And not only, you know, Waldsterben, the death of the forest, but the death of the lakes. And the fish.
And the birds.
And the birds. And what?
Maple syrup.
Hey, maple, I love maple syrup.
I just wanted to respond to your example there. I think, to me, it does sound like in that case the EPA really loved up because it couldn't make up its mind. But another thing it illustrates, I think, is the importance of that. Indeed, it shows that the EPA is the only one that can do pollution control effectively. private industry can't afford to be more stringent than the law requires.
Or won't.
Well, won't, because we live in a very competitive free market, so that when the regulation changed from a more stringent one to a less stringent, they couldn't afford to stay at the stricter. They had to fall back to the less. Or would, you know, we could attribute ill will to it. I guess I don't want to attribute ill will to a company unless we know that it's, you know, really malicious. But I think I've talked to enough executives from companies that are trying to be good, but who have said, look, if we try on our own to do less pollution and be, you know, adhere to more stringent standards, our competitor down the road will sell more products at a cheaper price. And I think that pollution control is something that has to be done by government regulation, because obviously if you can get by dumping as much toxic waste as possible for free rather than having to deal with it, you're going to be able to sell at a cheaper price. So I guess I would say it seems like the weak link in that system was both an EPA that couldn't make up its mind, and that's not good, obviously, but also the fact that that all the nations of the world don't have the same standards. That's a problem, and Mexicans are breathing much worse air than we are. I think this whole thing with the ozone situation is really interesting, with, for example, nations that haven't yet developed fluorocarbons to the extent that we have, like China, India, countries asking us to actually pay them to not produce, is a really interesting and quite fair approach to the situation, in which if we're going to regulate, it has real economic consequences, and it has to be done at the government level and now at the world level. And, we got to pollute for free with a lot of years of reusing fluorocarbons, and shouldn't they be allowed the same years for free? I think we should help subsidize pollution control for other countries as well.
How about going back to the number? How many are ready to do that?
I live in the desert.
The Pacific Northwest, you know,
that's a problem.
Well, I remember when I growing up in Chicago, back in the 30s, how on a real hot night in July and August, we used to go down to the lakefront and try and get some breeze because there wasn't any air conditioning. But then we didn't have a problem with the ozone.
You slept on the lake?
No, not quite, but we drove along there to try and get, you know, with the windows down to try and get, but a lot of people did.
Yeah.
Scores of people did.
Well, there are safe refrigerants, though.
I suppose there are.
They're going to cost a little more, but that's the price.
That's where cars coming out are going to have the new refrigeration units in it, because they're sure they're going to pay for it. Well, see, that's what we have to decide.
I see so many symbols of backbone up there. You see that chart from the boss.
Yeah.
We can make changes. We can watch that to be asking, and we're doing it up here. I think we can make some changes.
I decreed, for example, in LWR that we will not buy any styrofoam cups. And even if LWR has to go out and get you a China cup, but we're not going to get any stuff. It's small, you know, but it, how many maybe
small,
know, 10 cups of tea or something. Well, the point is, that's what it's going to take. It's going to take each of us.
Right.
You say it's small, it's not that small, because inside of every one of those little pellets is freedom, and it is the cancer-causing issue. And we drink coffee out of it. People don't feel like they've been going on for years. Because they've been in the medical journey, and even drink tea out of it before you fall.
I just happened to look what my office sent me. And I don't know, is this for you?
They're packing styrofoam and LWR even while you're not playing.
See, that's, as soon as I leave, you see what happens.
In Portland, Oregon.
Our fortress packs it. They have the right to. Oh, yes. Yeah.
See, they could do that plastic little bubble thing, which would do the same for how they know it. I like the snap.
The city of Portland has banned.
But there's even a battle about that, because now they're using styrofoam experimentally to make materials as hard and durable as wood that can be used in lieu of wood.
Minneapolis, I think, next July 1st or something, is said the same thing. No more styrofoam.
What's our
workers
going to do?
Back at
it, boys. They should.
Have a comment over here?
Yeah, to say that you can recycle styrofoam with plastic is not completely true. You see what the true definition of recycle. To find an alternate use for styrofoam. Closing your eyes to the problem that's there, because it's not going to biodegrade or the plastic. And there's a way to put plastics together and say, you can fire it, you can do recycle, and it just creates another use for them, it creates another product. And you know, to use that up and sort of appease the God through coming from the
styrofoam and plastic is not in the same category.
They can, and they are not the same chemical.
Well, last fall, before the elections, there was a little political caucus thing, and one of the candidates was talking to a group, and he was asked, "What are the couple most important considerations for the state of Washington?" And he went through about 12, and environmental problems was never even in the top 10 or 12. And this he got elected. He's there.
I find it interesting that the Green Party, which has seats now in Germany, in the parliament, in Sweden, in Eastern Europe, that concept hasn't apparently got hold. I wonder why. Are we, you know, so sure and so content to it? I wonder why that isn't being picked up.
We're all the cause of our own problems.
Yeah.
We don't want to blame ourselves.
Well, like Dick mentioned, you know, he gets the loggers beating on his brains because he's restricting how much wood he's going to give the loggers. Those in the environmental group, of course, are beating on him because he's giving out too much. He says, then I think I'm probably pretty much on the right track, but the logging pays the politicians more than the rest of us do.
Emo, how about up in Canada? What's happening in the environmental area there? Are there greens?
I'm not quite familiar with that.
Well,
the Green Party.
No.
Yeah.
Environmentalists, you know.
Yes, well, that word is used a lot. They're introducing a lot of strict regulations concerning so many things. These things we're talking about, the waste, and the fact that we have built in place that we're not River. Toxic waste, various kinds, very dangerous wastes. And we trucked up the barrels, sealed barrels, to be, you know, to be eliminated in this, this planet.
And then what happens when the leak occurs? Then it gets, you know, I live in New Jersey. It has the most toxic waste dumps in the entire country. It was at least in the top three, if not the top.
A lot of our toxic waste are shipped to places in the U.S.
Are they?
There's been arrangements made.
Yeah,
because we don't have any land.
And then what happens to it, though? It goes into the soil, into the water, and you drink it.
We drink bottled water, for example.
I mean, the water is certified clean and drinkable. People prefer to buy a bottle of water for 59 cents a gallon.
Can you recycle the bottle?
Well, yes. These happen to be plastic, good, non-biodegradable plastic bottles, you see. So, how can you be sure that it's good? We're not sure, except we assume that it's been certified by Pure Food and Drug Act or Emo and then Ren?
Yes. And also refineries and such things. Wherever there's a smokestack, they are being tested all the time. That's some works in the garbage dumps outside of our cities up there, they get, after a while, they get to be quite big. Mm-hmm. So now, it takes not only months, but I think years to come to some kind of conclusion where they can start a new garbage dump to repair the waste in our cities. And now it's come to the point where the garbage just doesn't come and pick that, but there comes a blue truck that comes and picks up certain materials, certain areas that are left in certain trucks and garbage trucks, just like the rest of it.
And we finally
here in this waste village.
Yeah.
Well, does this lead us to the point where each family should brainstorm a list of things that we should do? I mean, in my situation, is entirely different from somebody's 40 years old or 30 years old, but what should I do? And it goes right down from don't use this cup to write a letter to Joe Blow to put aside some money for the Bishop's Fund or Lutheran World Relief or something to help out there. But there are things I can do right in my little address, and I probably should be doing it.
Well, that's interesting, you know.
Well, I just wanted to put in a little plug for, I know Amy's not a garbologist anymore, but for visiting the Holden garbology teams, all our staff are required to put in a garbology team, and I invite guests to do that too. It's really an eye-opening experience to see how the garbage is sorted into all different kinds, and the paper is incinerated, all the food garbage is composted, the metals, the glass are sorted by color and type and recycled. And I think it's a model for, you know, obviously it's not perfect here. Some stuff is buried, like the plastic and some things that there's nothing you can do with them. But I think it's really inspiring how anything you throw away, it's not really going away. I mean, somebody has to do something with it. And here at home, we're really conscious of that. And just to put it a couple hours with it, your walls can be super real eye-opening and very inspiring, too.
I'm just thinking, I saw it 10 years ago, Newsweek. Now I see that the new city of L.A. will be San Diego, Santa Barbara, for 25 million. There's no place to build anything else. So I say we have to find a solution, like you say.
It's interesting in Europe, Switzerland and Germany, for example. In Switzerland, where I was just recently, about a month ago, they have a big metal container divided into three: white glass, green glass, brown glass. They're in various places, and you just take your bottle and you throw it through a hole, and then the city comes and picks that up and brings another one and puts it down there. We're finally, in New Jersey, finally separating our paper from our bottles, from tin cans we haven't even got to. Pop cans.
Yeah. How many states
have bottles? Oh, to return the Coke bottle, or I mean, the can?
Bottles, cans, plastic.
Plastic. Now even wine coolers.
In Oregon, just
Oregon is, of course, one of the leading states. Somebody can say that with anybody else. I mean, I know Minnesota is also pretty much up in there. But we've got to do more, and and the reason we're not is because we seem to be in big apathy.
I'd like to see some way to reduce all the packaging. Wouldn't have one here if you didn't have corsets and packages and the bubbles and the.
No, that's true.
You mentioned the
bubbles. Like they used to be.
Wrap a napkin.
Well, the point is of the whole thing is that the world is at risk. We've got to start changing some of our views, and we can be instruments in that change. What was acceptable yesterday, I think, must not be acceptable today and in the future. And otherwise, what we leave for our children and grandchildren surely is not going to be what we are enjoying today. Thank you very much.